Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, November 22nd. We have a Hanaho show for you today. As we head into the holiday season, we're showing our appreciation for educators. We're re-airing our impactful teacher series that was broadcast earlier this year. We share the story of how one teacher's word of wisdom about keeping your nose clean sent her student on a career path with the FBI. We revisited an interview with a college professor who grew up on the Big Island and helped mold minds while at Yale University. We hear about the legacy of a McKinley High School teacher that includes her son and one of the conversation's producers. Plus, we take a trip to the Big Island to meet a Kohala teacher whose style had an influence on a voice that you hear right on our show.
Snapping, losing it, going off the deep end. All terms for the moment when we become consumed with fury and become a stranger to ourselves.
This neighbor came up the road in the bulldozer and was pushing over trees, and something just snapped.
The deep logic of irrational rage. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Even when your days shift and change, some things don't. Like HPR keeping you informed with news you can trust, and providing an oasis of music when you need it. So stick with your routine and stay connected at home. Listen to HPR on air, online, or on your smart speaker. Whether you're working in your street clothes or in your pajamas, HPR is here for you. Just ask your smart speaker to play Hawaii Public Radio.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. In recognition of World Teachers Day last month, we acknowledged some educators who made significant impacts on their students, including some of the staff here at Hawaii Public Radio. At this time of year, as we count our blessings, we're encoring those interviews out of gratitude of the ways that teachers impact our lives. We kick off our show with a nod to Sister James. She's a nun who helped former FBI agent and educator Arnold La'anui along the path to a long career with the federal agency. He honed his skills as an investigator, working across the world in places like Kenya, Lebanon, and Indonesia. He recently returned home to take over as principal of his alma mater, Damien High School. He left the school after he was asked to step down following a scandal that shook the school community to its core. He filed a whistleblower lawsuit alleging wrongful termination for flagging violations of law in the football program. He says it was something Sister James told his elementary school class that stuck with him. She said, "Keep your noses clean because you never know when the FBI is going to come calling."
As a young sixth grader, you know, I'm 11 years old, I didn't know what the FBI was. But then it planted a seed which grew into a curiosity, and that curiosity eventually turned into a vocation where I was ultimately called to kind of serve. And as the years and decades went by, I always maintained that relationship with Sister James. And what I would do every Teacher Appreciation Week in May, I would always write her a little thank you card with the same message in it. And it would basically say, "This isn't me working, this is you working through me working." And I'd always say that because I put in all the clippings, newspaper clippings of all the cases or things I'd been involved in as an investigator. I'd clip them on a newspaper and I'd stick it in there with, you know, and as the years went by, I had fun with it. I'd always throw in a gift card. But the gift card would range from different places, from Long's or Foodland to a Subway or Taco Bell, you know, or Starbucks. Eventually Starbucks became a thing. And so as the years and decades went by, I always paid an annual visit with her, sometimes in person on campus. But if I was far away, I'd get a card, stick it in the mail, and make sure that it would kind of get out to her. But yeah, always thought about her and was always just very, very grateful for how she launched more than a career. She really launched a vocation.
It's just amazing because you never know what kind of spark you will nurture in a child. And
yeah, absolutely.
I think it's just a really wonderful story that you have thought of her. And so when I had the opportunity to talk to you when you returned home to take that job as principal of your alma mater, I was really taken by that story and how much she had influenced your life. I didn't forget that, but I know that you've been going through a difficult time now because you had to leave that position, and it was a position that you really, were so proud to have.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was somewhat of a public disappointment, of course, to kind of leave Damien, certainly prematurely. But the matter certainly, I believe, turned over to the right legal team, and things will work out. I'm a huge believer in justice and, once again, of course, vocations. I've been really fortunate not only at my time at Damien, but certainly for, like, honestly, several decades, having the opportunity to counsel numerous students into numerous vocations, whether it was into vocations in the health arena, and eventually some of them became physicians, or many of them, of course, because of my prior law enforcement experience, they serve in law enforcement agencies all over the place, from the Secret Service and the Air Marshals to just recently I got a notice that a young man that I had been counseling is currently at the FBI Academy. I've been really fortunate, to kind of pay it forward a little bit. You know, and something that Sister James told me still resonates. It's that teachers really are farmers, but what they farm is the future. It's a lot of hard work. Your hands will get dirty when you do it. But in the end, the crop that you harvest is one that's paid off many, many decades into the future. And maintaining that future perspective, always kind of looking forward, I think not only helps, obviously, in education, but helps in life as well.
And the crops can be bountiful.
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
And you had shared that Sister James gave you a little gift, too.
Oh, yeah. Something I'm really grateful for. In fact, I'm in my home office right now, and I'm turning around and I'm looking right at it. When she took her oath as a young nun with the Sisters of St. Joseph's Condillet, she handed to me a cross that she had taken her oath on. And on the back of it, interestingly, is inscribed in Latin, Ecce Venio. You see Ecce Venio throughout the Bible, but you see it prominently in the book of Hebrews, where basically it says, behold, I come to do God's work. And we'd always talk about like doing God's work and how difficult it is to kind of do that. So yeah, she's still with us, but aging, of course, and kind of bedridden these days. But yeah, her handing me that cross, it's now my mission to kind of carry those footsteps a little bit forward and carry her cross a little bit more forward too, to do God's work and everything I try to do. Yeah, it actually means a lot. So once again, Sister James, still paying it forward.
Well, I have to admit, I thought of you and felt terrible when I saw you in the news with the headlines, and I know you made a difficult decision to file a lawsuit over Damien, over some things that you thought were not proper and not lawful. And that's working its way right now through the courts. But I wondered what you had thought before you went public with those concerns, you know, about what Sister James had taught you about doing the right thing.
There comes a time, I guess, in everybody's life, you know, where something might you might be afraid of. But one of the things that Sister James taught me, too, was, I mean, obviously, it's those wonderful aphorisms that you kind of get as you grow up, right? Always do your best. Always put your best foot forward, of course. But not being afraid of doing the right thing. And oftentimes, folks can so easily just become afraid of just standing up and putting yourself out there. It was something that, obviously, the seed was planted by her. But I got to admit, too, it was something that was also kind of honed by my time in the FBI. You know, when I was in her classrooms, and I was in anticipation of this interview, I was thinking a lot about what she really taught me. She taught me some really key things that really laid a foundation for a career in the justice field, which was, one, paying attention, like looking at the little things and paying attention to the details. She would often have me, you know, do my assignment over when she would turn over like a worksheet I had done, and she said, you underlined the noun, but the instructions say circle the noun. And I was like, what? No, it's the same thing, right? She says, no, it's not the same thing. And then she'd have me do it all over. And then as time went on, the second lesson she kind of taught me was in the course of like trying to do some math and coming up to a solution with something, she'd always say, okay, explain how you got there. When I would raise my hand and ask a question, she'd always say, explain how you got there. Explain what brought you to this conclusion. And being able to gather, as an FBI agent, gather evidence, collect it, correlate it, catalog it, and then honestly explain how you got to your conclusion and paying attention to detail, those are things that make for great detectives and great investigators. Great attorneys, great lawyers develop those fundamental skills. And they got honed at a very, very young age. And I'll never forget how important it was to just pay attention to detail, and then how to gather and collect evidence, and then present your case, explain how you got there. I'm endeared to her, not only for that, of course, but the other things, you know, paying attention to who I was as a person, always inquiring about like my family and how my family was doing. She still would always ask the exact same things when I visit with her. Yeah, those are special moments.
When you said that phrase, pay attention, I immediately flashed back to a time as a kid and being in mass and getting pinched.
Uh-huh.
Pay attention.
Right. Catholic school education.
Yes, absolutely. Well, is there anything you want to share? I mean, the lawsuit, it was scandalous, and you had to figure out, you know, the people were going to get hurt.
The best lies always seem to have a shred of truth in them. And oftentimes, folks will kind of incorporate shreds of truth into that to kind of make them a little bit more believable. But in the end, you know, fake stories only work on people who want to be kind of lied to. We have a duty and an obligation as educators to be an example for the next generation. And if we aren't good examples, if we are not representing ourselves to them honestly, how do we expect this next generation, our future, to represent themselves to others honestly? So, yeah, I think in coming to that conclusion, coming to that decision about what honesty looks like, what our obligation as educators and teachers are, it raises a lot of questions. Not only one, certainly of the competencies you would expect a student to kind of have in the classroom, but also the ethics you would expect them to demonstrate outside of the classroom. And Damien is a Catholic education. Faith plays an important role in that. And some of the rules that are embedded in this book called the Bible have transcended thousands and thousands of years. They're relatively simple rules that are in there, simple to read, simple to understand, but I guess at times not simple to follow. And really by standing up and throwing a flag on the play at my alma mater is my attempt to ensure that we follow those rules to the best of our ability.
If you had to condense what your lawsuit is about.
In a nutshell, the lawsuit deals with my charging my alma mater with violating one of our key principles. One of the key principles that we have at Damien is that we follow what we call the essential elements of a gentleman by the name of Blessed Edmund Rice, who's the founder of the congregation that leads the school. One of the key elements of that is that we lift those marginalized by poverty and injustice. Now, Damien, the school, was kind of founded in a community that's low income. I'm from that neighborhood. I know exactly what that low income living is like. But at the core of my allegation, one of the key principles that's in it is that Damien has been making and has been accepting illicit scholarship payments to its football athletes. Now, in order to receive that, some might think that this is a wonderful chance for folks to have an opportunity to elevate a chance of a family to get a private education. But at its core, this isn't about opportunity. A lot of it is about favoritism. And the reason it's about favoritism is because the individuals receiving those scholarships have been football players. As a result of being football players, of course, they're male. And there are several rules that kind of violate that. The key principle that's kind of being violated is that in order to give illicit scholarships that are prohibited by the ILH, you literally have to step over families in great financial crisis and ignore every female student in order to do that. That doesn't level the playing field for anybody. It violates ILH recruitment and incentivization and financial aid rules. And because it violates those rules, it also violates tax laws. And as a result of violating those laws, Damien has got an obligation to make things right. And along the way, when all of the money is kind of misdirected to ineligible athletes in the form of these illicit payments and scholarships, my allegation is also that with what little dollars are kind of left, I've had coaches submit a fraudulent invoice intended to kind of cover some bonuses that the athletic department thought that they were entitled to. But it wasn't one that was necessarily budgeted for. And the invoice wasn't, of course, for any type of a bonus. It was for something else. What was happening was the Damien Alumni Association and Damien School were intentionally defeating both ILH rules that serve to protect the integrity of our football teams and all the competitors, but also effectively undermining both state and federal tax laws. And it effectively evaded these rules, which are designed to limit the amount of undue financial influence. And in doing so, my alma mater not only compromised sportsmanship, but certainly compromised the school's integrity.
That was Arnold Laanui, former principal of Damien High School and former FBI agent, talking to us about Sister James. She inspired him to get into a career in law enforcement. As for his legal challenge, the case is currently in mediation. When the lawsuit was filed, the school released a statement saying it was taking the charges seriously and that student safety and education were its highest priority. Hawaii Island is home to a stunning array of biodiversity. Growing up there, who wouldn't become interested in science? Well, that's what producer Maddie Bender thought when she was reflecting on the career of the college professor who she credits most with shaping her interest in evolutionary biology. Turns out he was born and raised on the Big Island. Stephen Stearns is the Edward P. Bass Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology Emeritus at Yale University. He pioneered the fields of life history evolution and evolutionary medicine. Maddie's first question for him, why did he decide to leave Hawaii?
I was born into the supervisory class on a sugar plantation that was had a post-colonial structure. And what that meant is that I was the only white kid in my class in elementary school, and I got beaten up. As we got towards puberty, when I got to be 10 years old, I was beaten up in my own front yard once, and I was knocked down and jeered and kicked in line waiting for school lunch. And I really had really bad psychological problems from that. So that's when my parents decided that they needed to send me to boarding school and come along, my man. From that point on, I didn't really feel like I belonged. So there was a lot of racial tension. There was a lot of class and ethnic tension. And I felt that the folks who had created it were the Howleys, the white people, who had created the post-colonial structure and who dominated the economy of Hawaii. Watch John Oliver. John Oliver did a pretty good job.
It's a Hawaii that some people willfully try not to remember, but you were born right after the 1946 Hilo tsunami. It seems to me that that also kind of shaped your worldview.
Tsunamis and volcanoes and hurricanes were all things that really made the power of nature very immediate and personal. I would say, actually, it was probably more the Kapoho eruption of 1960 that shaped me, because we had a house down there, and I went night diving by the light of a volcanic fountain and caught a lobster without using a flashlight. So that's an extraordinary experience. But that that whole bay of Kapoho and our house is now under 75 feet of lava from the 2018 eruption.
Yeah. I grew up going to a house in the Rockaways, which was destroyed during Hurricane Sandy. It makes it personal when that natural disaster happens to you.
Right. It wipes out a part of your life.
Yeah.
But I'm still very interested in that. And I've been following, I followed the recent Kilauea eruption pretty closely. You know, they have cams that you can see stuff on. And so I'm still very tuned in to what's going on in Hawaii. It's always been an important part of me, but I have deeply conflicted emotions about it.
Did you feel like the sheer nature and biodiversity shaped your interest in evolution and evolutionary theory?
I think the fact that both my parents were naturalists who were very interested in nature did that. My father was a fisherman and a botanist. He greatly enjoyed taking us up in the rainforest and pointing out club mosses and things like that. And my mother introduced me to skin diving when I was 4 years old. So I have a pretty detailed memory of what the whole Kohala Coast looks like underwater, from north of Mahukona down to about Anaiho'omalu. That's quite a stretch. It's about 30 miles. So it's depressing to go back and see most of it dead now. But I had wonderful wonderful experiences.
You mentioned your parents both being naturalists, but you also come from a line of educators. And so did that influence at all your decision to go into being a teacher?
Looking back at it, I think the fact that both my aunt and my mother were teachers certainly had something to do with it. But what I primarily remember is how desperately motivated I was to have an academic career where I could do research. And that really helped me to push through some tough times. I was not a very good teacher when I began. I began in the summer of 1975 teaching marine ecology at the Bodega Marine Lab to kids from California. And I overprepared seriously. I didn't give them space and I didn't give them agency. And I just crammed the lessons full of stuff because I felt kind of responsible. And I had to learn how to back off and give students space. And that took a while. And so when I went to Switzerland in 1983, I started off lecturing, and it was a catastrophe because I was having to lecture in German, which I was just learning. And I learned enough German so that I could lecture pretty well in German after about 5 years. But I decided that lectures were really not a very interesting experience for students. So I began to design other kinds of structures. And that's, I think, when I really got emotionally hooked by teaching. It was during my time in Switzerland. And when I came to Yale, I had to go back into a lecture structure again because I taught intro bio for 10 years with, 80 to 160 students. And you can't do that without lecturing. After I finished my 10 years of teaching intro bio, my colleagues were so grateful for the fact that I had done that, that I had taken that off their backs and let them do other things. They told me I could teach any way I wanted for the rest of my career. So that's when I invented the structure that you encountered.
Yeah, I want to kind of describe the structure of the courses that you became really well known for teaching in, the flipped classroom model, if you want to call it that, where we were tasked with watching these short, very digestible lectures every other night, reading a little bit in a textbook, and then having class time being dedicated really to that thinking and reacting, but also learning in the moment. And it was like a seminar style that you don't often see in STEM classes.
It was the way that I taught from about 2016 until I retired. And the last time I taught it was the fall of 2020. So I had the book and I had the lectures. And then I decided that the way that I would teach is that I would ask the students to look at lectures and do readings. And then importantly, answer prompts online and get my comments on their prompts before they were allowed to come to class. And we could use class time to concentrate on two things: what's really interesting and what is it that people haven't understood. And usually the way you experience this, the way that I would structure class is that I'd welcome everybody in and say, okay, I'd like to have one of you put up what's interesting and one of you put up what is difficult and not understood, and I'll be back in 5 or 10 minutes. And I'd walk out of the room, and every time I came back in, there was always an intense conversation going on. So that turned out to be very stimulating. The professor leaves the room and people really talk. And then usually what we would do is we would go through the list and I would ask people to say why they put that up or what it was they didn't understand. And often we ran out of time.
I realize now also that you definitely had an affinity for wearing Aloha shirts in class, although at the time, like, I never even heard of it. So I was like thinking to myself, why is my professor wearing a shirt with swordfish all over it? I think you were maybe one of, if not the only professor at Yale who would do that.
There were at least two others who picked up on it. Both Paul Turner and Gunter Wagner started wearing Aloha shirts.
So you influenced them in more ways than one. But then I think you look at just a sampling of all the people you've influenced, all the people that you can now say have gone on to be scientists or journalists, other academics. There are generations upon generations of people who've gone into a science field And they will all say that it was your teaching in your course. So is that correlation or is that causation?
Well, I'd like to think that it's causation. I like to think that I actually took young people and showed them a wonderful world that they could inhabit and that they could make it their own. And I tried to provide them with structures that made them feel like they could make it their own. And many of them did. I had the great privilege, Maddie, of spending 45 years of my life in contact with young people, and I could feed like a parasite off of their optimism and their energy, which I did. And I hope I gave them something back that they found valuable. And I think that anybody who is considering a career that involves some teaching, if they think creatively about how to do it so that they create value for themselves because they have put some of themselves into the design of what they're doing, they'll get paid back in spades.
Is there any other general teaching advice you'd give?
Well, I think that there is some truth in the bootstrap theory of value, and that is there isn't really any value that's out there in nature. The nature doesn't care about value or about the meaning of life and things like that. But as we make choices and then we invest in our choices, they become valuable to us, and they become valuable to us pretty much in proportion to how much we've invested in them. And so this is kind of a double-edged sword, because it means if you're young and you're looking ahead at your life, it's kind of hard to pick out what is going to make your life meaningful. But you do have, all of us have certain talents and predilections, and they can guide our initial choices. And then if we invest in those choices, realizing that everybody has to pay dues and it's not always going to be easy at the beginning, but if you can work through that and continue to make it better and better, it will become more and more meaningful in kind of a positive feedback loop until after you've done it for 10 or 20 years, you can't imagine doing anything else. But it didn't look like that going in. It looked confusing going in. And there were lots of options going in. And perhaps it didn't matter which one you picked so much as that when you picked it, you really made it your own and you took ownership of it.
It was you actually who told me the career advice that I have probably repeated most, which was what you do with your life should be an intersection of this Venn diagram of what you like doing, what you're good at, and what people pay you to do.
Yep, I still say that. when you think about it, it's fairly obvious. But I've really been struck by how many people I've met who decided that they were going to go into investment banking or something like that. And they made enough money so they could retire when they were in their 50s, and they feel empty. And I think it's much better to fill your life with hours that you enjoyed, doing things that you thought were valuable, and that you have to be hauled kicking and screaming into retirement rather than sprinting joyously into it and then discovering that you're floating in a vacuum. In my case, I was ready to retire, but boy, did I enjoy those 45 years. They were great. And I'm still enjoying my time now. I just do it differently. I've got a great partner. I've got a great dog, and I live in a beautiful place. We have a pileated woodpecker who comes to the suet on our front porch. And every time I look out, I'm looking out the window. As you're looking at me, I'm looking out the window. The chances are that any big bird that I see is a bald eagle.
Wow.
Which is great.
All right. Well, I just wanted to thank you again for taking the time. It's been great to catch up.
Well, it's good to see you, Maddie. And, you know, I can remember what your face looked like 10 or 12 years ago, and you've grown up. Funny.
You're going to make me cry.
Funny about that. Yeah. You look great.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Stearns, Professor Emeritus at Yale University. He spoke with his former student and teaching assistant, HPR's Maddie Bender.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
Saturday night on The Real Deal, big hits of 24. That's 1924. Songs of 100 years ago, heard in original and later versions that are still in circulation today. That's The Real Deal. Member-supported HPR 1, 8 to 10, Saturday night.
Welcome back to our Impactful Teachers Hanaho Show. Bailey Sarah was a McKinley High School English teacher for more than 30 years. During that time, she coached the speech club and is regarded as a pioneer of the Hawaii Speech League. The Conversations Lillian Song was a student of hers in the late 1980s. Sarah died in 2019, but her son Darren carries on her legacy. He's been a teacher for 33 years, the last 10 teaching music at Stevenson Middle School. He shares how his mom's influence endures in his classroom today.
When I see the kids start from zero musically, and then they start to play music, actual music, and they see that in themselves, and isn't this fun? You know, start at zero, and now we're playing whatever songs you want to try. And the first week, I tell them, this is a safe place. And we're going to try different things, and don't be afraid to make mistakes. And the only person that gets to tease other people is me. So I'm going to look at you and say, that can be better. We have a yay rule where we say yay for each other. If I like something, I'll say yay. And everyone goes, yay. Yep, they're waiting for me to say that, like a badge of honor. So when I finally say yay for them, they feel like they accomplished something. So they're waiting for it. I go, not yet. I go, maybe tomorrow. And I finally say yay. And they're like, yay, I got a yay from Mr. Sarah. So we always strive for something better every time we play. I know we can get there, but they don't know yet. So that's why I need to focus there. Excitement. I was kind of barking at them today, but they know it's like a coach. I'm a coach. So we got to learn this play. We got to learn this, you know, position. And they look at each other. Come on, people, we can do it. We can do it.
The reason why I reached out to you is because when I was in high school at McKinley, my English teacher was your mom, Mrs. Sarah. And she was a big blessing in my life because in ninth grade, I was a quiet student who loved words but was a wallflower, would never really express myself. But she actually said, Lillian, you are joining the speech club. I know. And it's like, it scared me. It scared me so much because here I am, a freshman. High school is so new to me. But we had a place to go to. Speech club was my entry point to discovering other people like myself who were learning through your mom. She coached us. She, just like you, repetition. She made us practice. It became like I found my tribe. And just in that sense of, wow, I can do this because I have somebody like Mrs. Sarah being very, she gave us a lot of tough love. I'm not going to say this is all like, you know, rainbows and sunshine. No, we worked.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Made us work. And just like you're saying, you need to have that discipline. And she made us practice. And then when we're ready, she made us enter competitions. And then from the competitions, realizing, wow, I did really well. I got notes back from judges. And then realizing I can express myself not just through the written word, but with the spoken word, using my voice in different ways. And she opened up the doors in my mind to like explore other possibilities like theater and drama. I mean, then I went on to college radio and like now I'm doing public radio. And so when we were talking about, you know, impactful teachers in our lives, I'm going to tell you, Mrs. Sarah just like, boom, top of the list.
She definitely must have seen something in you. And I saw her do it every year. She worked hard. I mean, bringing home papers and Saturday at the tournaments, and her job was her life. And I watched her, and they always say, if you have a job that you love, you never work a day in your life. And she was complete when she was a teacher. I think she kind of got bored when she retired. That's why she kept teaching at Chaminade. But seeing the kids, you know, they gave her all the mana and all the joy in her life, and she just felt like a person that had meaning. And that was the reason why she was here, you know, here on earth, to be a good teacher. So when I had to teach myself, I always think, can I say that? Am I doing something that I can be proud of? And there are days, you know, like, oh boy, you know. But most of the times I think I do enough that I think I make my mom proud, and I think I'm satisfying the definition of what a teacher is in my head. And you should inspire. I want a kid to come to me and say, thank you for that, or I get it now. And even after the third, fourth, fifth try, you know, say, you understand? You get it? I'm never going to deny a student to ask a question. And if they're curious, they're enthusiastic, and they're honest, you know, their learning is through them, not me. I mean, if you only learn what I tell you, you're not going to learn enough. I'm just trying to fight that fire, and you're going to take it from me and say, I got this, and then I don't have to worry about you. But my belief that I got from my mom is that I'm teaching you how to learn, and learning is a good thing. And you're going to be doing things that I never even thought, you know, could be done. And you're going to surprise me. And I'm going to say, that's awesome. What you're doing right now is awesome. Good for you, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have stories of musicians in my career, but my mom, we would go anywhere, and there's people thanking her. And looking back at their high school years, with my mom shining for 2-3 minutes, and I said, they look very happy, Mom. You did that. And they were so glad they saw you, and they gave my mom a big hug. And I said, that's what you did. And sometimes she's like, I was just a teacher for 1 or 2 years. I go, that's enough. Like, you made an impact. Look at them now. They look so, we saw their family. You know, we saw the men at their job or whatever. They seemed like their memories of high school was, you know, 100+1 because of you. But she was perfect for that. She loved her job.
Right. And like you were saying, though, with students who have graduated, recognizing Mrs. Sarah when we're no longer in the classroom setting. I remember when you came and helped coach us.
I was so happy that she trusted me. I felt honored to take over the team for her, but it gave me respect that way. So she wasn't like a little kid. But yeah, I remember the rehearsals at our house. I mean, it was like a speech camp kind of thing, hours and hours, and then we'd have a meal and practice some more. It was fun, though. It didn't feel like work. I was getting busy at UH, though, so I had to drop it, but I think my last year when I went to Nationals, it was like my feather in the cap that, you know, we did it at least one time. But yeah, my mom, when she retired, she always asked me questions how things were working. Her presence in OHPC was impressive because she was one of those pioneers. You know, other coaches from other schools would ask her questions when she did come around. So she'd be pleased that, you know, people show her that respect. And so she has a, you know, whole line of coaches from under her. So the lineage of coaching, it's amazing. It's been a while since I've gotten involved in OHPC, but her name and Miss Kubota, Miss Ishimoto, they're the three. And certainly Radford coaches and Kwame and all the different schools had their top coaches, but those are the glory years of OHPC, the 70s, 80s, probably the 90s, still going strong. It's all because of the three women.
Wow. And you did share with me, too, that she actually started teaching when she was 21 years old.
You know, if I could fact check that, because I think she actually started earlier, but I'll say 21 right now, but because she started college when she was 15.
Wow.
Because she came out of school from the Philippines. So I think she actually graduated Northern Colorado when she was 19. Yeah, she was a phenom entering college when she was 15. That I know for sure. So probably my mom were alive, she's like, how can you forget the stories? It's been years, but yeah, she was a go-getter from the very beginning. She was very, very young when she started.
Wow. And so, Darren, when I do the math, and this is just based on my layperson's perspective, but if your mom was teaching freshman English, she was a coach, club advisor for over 30 years, it's amazing that she was instrumental in beginning the Hawaii Speech League back in the 60s.
Yes.
So how many students has she touched here in Hawaii, do you think? Myself included.
Oh my
wow.
Yeah. If you say at least 100 a year, I mean, that's a low minimum. Yeah. Got to be in the thousands. And it's mind-boggling. Yeah. And, you know, you're talking about the impact of teachers. And in a way, my mom still teaches me how to be a teacher. I'm always thinking of her. So that's what drives me. And I ask myself almost daily, would my mom approve? Am I doing it the way she would do it? And she wasn't a school musician, skilled musician. She didn't like music, but I would say, I think my mom would like this, you know. And my song choices, my repertoire choices, I'm like, if this is good, I know I would say that good job, Darren, that you're on the right track. So it still inspires me. He still inspires me to do my best. And it'll be like that for the rest of my career. You know, you always want to make your mentors happy. But she's definitely mine.
That was Stevenson Middle School music teacher Darren Serra, who's in his 33rd year of teaching. He was talking to HPR's Lillian Song about his mother, Faye Serra, who mentored her at McKinley High School. Mrs. Serra taught at Castle and Farrington High School before calling McKinley her second home for more than 30 years. Darren says retirement was too quiet for his mom, so she then took up teaching at Chaminade University. Wendy Nickel is an administrator and teacher at Kohala Middle School. This is her 39th year in education, all at Big Island Schools. She started out in 1986 as a sixth grade teacher at Waimea Elementary. In the conversations, Russell Subiano was just 10 years old when he first walked into her class. The two reunited in Kona earlier this year.
That was Wendy Nichols' reaction upon seeing me after I interrupted a teacher's planning session on the campus of Kealakehi High School. In the nearly 40 years since I was in her sixth grade class at Waimea Elementary, I've crossed paths with her just once, and that was over 15 years ago.
Just so you remember me.
Of course I remember you.
Oh my gosh.
Good to see you.
I wish we could be in the AC. You know, there's like a lounge, you know.
Okay, we can go over there.
You want to check out
the seat? And then I'll tell you what I'm doing here. Don't forget your glasses, though.
Oh. Yeah.
After surprising Mrs. Nickel at work, essentially, we found a quiet space with air conditioning in the library. I'd coordinated my surprise visit with Kohala Middle School principal, Trisha Sanborn, who was happy to help but asked that I do one thing.
Trisha said I had to get your permission first. So can I have your permission to do this interview and to air it as part of our teacher appreciation series the first week of October?
Sure, but I'm going to start crying.
Here's the backstory. It was 1986. I was 10 and a good kid. I got good grades. But my family was sorting through a rough patch, to put it nicely. So school was my escape, but it wasn't necessarily a refuge. All of my previous teachers, from kindergarten to fifth grade, were good instructors. But they had also been in education for several years and had a very traditional approach to a classroom. Which is why a 20-something-year-old, fresh from college, Wendy Nickel, she was Wendy Sitsui at the time, made such a memorable impact on me. She was energetic and personable and hip to the times, and it was in her classroom that I first began to embrace my storytelling dreams. Flash forward nearly 40 years, and you can trace me talking on the radio in this moment right now to the impact she had on me. And so we talked about her beginnings in education and looked back over her still bustling 39-year career. It's my recollection that we were your first class. Is that true?
Yes. It was so memorable because I had so many of you smart Waimea kids, and it was my first time living in Waimea too. Mm-hmm. So very, very memorable that first year. It was so rewarding.
Looking back now, it feels like, you know, you had a lot of energy and you had a lot of excitement for being a teacher. Did you go to UH?
I went to UH, and then I worked like half-time jobs teaching on Oahu, mm-hmm. but I always wanted to come back to the Big Island. Yeah.
So where did you grow up, and what inspired you to become a teacher?
I grew up in Hilo, Hawaii, and had a wonderful childhood. First generation from my family to go to college. My parents worked really hard to support us in that endeavor. And when I was on Oahu going to UH Manoa, I needed a part-time job. I lived in the dorms. Across the street was an elementary school, and they had jobs for an after-school program. I never thought I wanted to become a teacher. I thought I would go into like a literary career or like maybe even a law career because I was an English major. And then when I worked with students, I was like, oh, I kind of like this. And the supervisory staff started giving me more responsibilities. So after I was done with my English degree, I said, okay, I want to try. So I went into education and got a certification.
And I'm all the better for it, and many of my classmates as well.
Oh, you're making my heart so full.
Had you not become a teacher, what other career would you have pursued? You mentioned that you would have pursued maybe a literary career. Uh-huh. Are you talking about like an author?
Some kind of publishing, or, you know, I was really influenced by Bamboo Ridge, Eric Chalk, and I can't remember the other director for Bamboo Ridge at UH Manoa. They did the literary review from UH Manoa. Or law, because I was really super fortunate to have a group of friends who were involved in the Hawaiian activism movement that was going on. I was privileged to go to Kaho'olawe after PKO got permission, you know, to start going and rehabilitating, attended Hawaiian language conferences. I didn't speak, but being born and raised in Hawaii, not ethnically Hawaiian, but being born and raised in Hawaii and having so much respect, I said, if I'm not going to do these two, you know, like either law or a literary career, I wanted to help people, like education, you know, so it worked out.
You are my sixth grade teacher, and from what I can tell, you still teach sixth grade?
I'm back in the classroom. Okay. I have been teaching sixth grade science. I've been doing many, many different roles at different schools on the Big Island, but my principal asked me to return to the classroom this year because our science teachers had to leave, so she's developing a science team. And so I was happy to say yes. Yeah.
When you became my sixth grade teacher, did you choose sixth grade or did sixth grade choose you?
Mrs. Pat Bergen, who I have mad respect for, chose me. I mean, you apply for a job and you get it. But I always liked older kids, and I was elementary certificated, you know, at that time. So sixth grade was the oldest group I could have.
What I remember about you is that you were kind and you were interested in students on a personal level. I remember you taking extra time to get to know each of us, giving us time to be spotlighted in a way and really shine a light on what made each of us unique. I remember you actually commissioned me to write a play about courtroom procedure, but all I really did was just like rehash what I seen on TV. I didn't do any research. So I look back now and I was like, what was I thinking? That kind of individual focus was not really something I remember in my school years beforehand, but it seems something that teachers are moving toward today or doing more of today. Why did you want that to be your style of teaching?
Every individual deserves respect. And also it was first year teacher, like desperately trying to keep you guys all involved and really into what we're doing, because sometimes, you know, what we have to teach, you might not be so interested in. But if you can, like you, Russell, you were so fun and you were so smart. It was like, I got to tap into this kid somehow, you know, like what his strengths are. And you were always willing to speak out. So you have to kind of look at what the kid's strengths are, you know, and even the quietest ones. Yeah, you have to try to find out.
Thank you for doing that, because storytelling has always been a huge part of my life. At that time in my life, it was just something that I had a compulsion to do and I felt like would make me interesting. But as I've grown, I find that it's really my calling. Another thing that I remember about you is that you were such a huge fan of Cyndi Lauper. Does your heart still beat for her today?
I still have the sweatshirt. I don't know if you remember. Yes. I went to her concert and I showed it to you all, the white sweatshirt with Cyndi Lauper on it. And I still have it to this day. I take it out every so often and it gets washed so it doesn't get all musty and it gets tucked back in. In fact, I'm going on a trip tomorrow. Maybe I should go dig it out and like wear it. I don't know. Anyway, oh my gosh. I am still a huge fan. Yeah. She's on my playlist. You know, when I'm working by myself in my classroom, she and The Green and, you know, various, but Cindy's on my playlist.
Every time I see her in something or hear her music, I immediately think of you. You're the biggest Cyndi Lauper fan I know of.
I was, I still am, so.
If you were my sixth grade teacher in 1986, that means that you've been teaching for nearly 40 years, or at least been in education for 40 years. I know teaching can be an incredibly rewarding job, but it's also well known that teachers here don't make that much. Mm-hmm. What's kept you in the profession for so long?
I love being with students. Even when I've been in my resource positions, I've always asked my administrators to give me a homeroom, study hall, advisory, some kind of group that I can just keep working with. You know, things don't change. From then till now, kids always need a trusted adult, you know, that they can talk to. And I love middle school. Like, I went from elementary up to middle school. That's my home for life for the rest of my teaching career. Teachers do not make enough money in the state of Hawaii. Our teachers union really strongly advocates for that, because if you hire people at a decent rate of pay, a working level rate of pay, able to afford a house, you will keep the very best. I feel like I have stayed because I've been fortunate, because Mr. Nickel stayed in as teaching. So we were able to, you know, hui our money together and raise our family together. We were really fortunate. I really worry about the young teachers now.
What's the biggest misconception the general public has about our public school teachers that you would like to see corrected?
I would say, just based on my more recent years, is that at the middle school and high school, we would like our parents to be even more involved, like with the academic pieces. And we try to reach out. You know, there's so many wonderful like online apps now, and the pandemic was bad, but it did teach us a lot about electronic communication, you know, with our parents. So the misconception is that when the kids get older, they need less, you know, like more hands-off. It's like, actually, you need to be more hands-on, because they need you to guide them and support them and really work as a team, yeah, with the teachers and the administration at the school. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Our parents are stretched thin, we all are, you know, and they're struggling too to make ends meet. It's just, it's a new world, you know, this millennium and this whole thing, it's a new world. The kids really need a lot of guidance. And if we can partner with our parents, that would just be like, and the ones that we do partner with, it's wonderful. And so the ones that are struggling, reach out to us. You know, we're here for you.
Do you have a favorite memory from your years in teaching, or maybe like a favorite student?
Oh my gosh, Russell, when I saw you at the door of the library, I was just like, so exciting. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for the time. That's kind of all the questions that I had for you. I'm so happy that I got to be able to talk to you and catch up with you. So thanks so much for your time.
Oh my gosh, Russell. My heart is singing. I am so full of joy. And yeah, just feeling fulfilled today. Thank you. Mahalo to you.
That was Kohala Middle School science teacher Wendy Nickel talking to her former student, HPR's Russell Subiono. That is it for this Aloha Friday and our impactful Teachers Hanaho. Don't forget to thank your favorite teacher. Coming up next week, we share the story of a visually impaired woman getting ready to run the Honolulu Marathon for the first time. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Tori DiGiornet. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.